Hey there, welcome to Our Desired, the podcast from Echoes, designed to help you be bold, stay fresh, and become a better design and innovation leader, with me, Juliana Proserpio. Hopefully, we can help you not only predict the future, but create it through the lenses of design and innovation. Do you think there is a connection between our personal stories from our past and the stories we tell about our futures? Tom Klinkenstein believes that our individual internal narratives, which are often formed in our childhoods, hold the key to how we design futures for ourselves and those around us. In the episode today, we're going to be talking about the design of futures and the intricate connection there is between futures and our individual internal narratives, initiated far back in our childhood memories. Tom, our guest, is an amazing designer, futurist professor at Hofstra University, and a gem professor at Pratt Institute and president of Media A, an innovation design and consulting group in New York with clients throughout the world. Tom started as a photographer at the age of 19. Then he moved to design and has developed a prolific career over the last 50 years. His work has been exhibited in amazing places like AIGA Gallery in New York, the Centre Pompidou in Paris, the Venice Biennale in Italy, and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Centre for Advanced Visual Studies, among many others. So the reason why we brought Tom to the show is because he coined the term moments of original manifestation to describe the formative moments in our lives that impact us so deeply that they set us on a new trajectory, a path that ultimately leads us to become who we are today and who we are in the future. For Tom, looking at what the future may be like, whether this is fictional or not, is a way to take responsibility for it. And really, this is what it means to be a designer today. Tom explores how moments of original manifestation end up defining the narratives of our future lives. And this is why he's super interesting for us. In conversation with his subjects, Tom strives to find the link between design and complexity, to confront the misunderstanding that design is about reducing, and simplifying. So every idea that we had from Bauhaus, where they said less is more, but really, design is much more complex than that. So he rather proposed a conversation about complexity. And with that, talking about complexity, do you think there is a link between design and futurism? Do the stories of our past define our future? Find out more in our conversation with Tom. This podcast was recorded in our innovation lab in São Paulo, and we were lucky to have Tom there, interviewed by Cuca Higini, architect and designer of learning experiences and culture at Echoes.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for being here with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Can you talk about these moments of original manifestation and the work that you develop around them?
You know, I have been interested in the beginnings of our individual journeys for many decades, but it's just in the past 2 or 3 years that I've formalized that interest into a phrase which myself and a friend, Joe Snyder in New York, call moment of original manifestation, when something happens randomly or perhaps in our family lives, or it could even be a dream. Often as a child or an adolescent, where we first notice that we exist, we have a metacognitive moment where we notice we exist and that in some linear or nonlinear way, some direct or indirect way, leads us to where we are at that particular moment. So this has really always been interesting to me since I was in my 20s, but it's just in the past few years that I've formalized it a bit and I have taken it as a theme in some research that I've been doing for a new project in the realm of design fiction. And then I also use it in my teaching and for workshops I've been giving in the past year or so.
How do these moments of original manifestation come about in your work? I mean, do you talk to people? Do you interview people? And how do you do that?
I give them a significant amount of time. I don't just block off 30 minutes for a business meeting or a business lunch. I block off 2 hours, knowing that I must get through the formal introductory language first, and then I will look for areas of interest and connection with that person to the point where they trust me with some secrets, if you will. Some of those secrets, which perhaps they have never articulated, are these moments of original manifestation. I do that through patience, sincerity, sharing my own moments, sharing my own quasi-secrets with people that I don't know well yet.
Mm.
And being a sincere believer in the dialogue as an exceptional state, and one of the most treasured states that we have as collective beings.
In order to get to this special treasured state in a dialogue, apart from the things that you have already mentioned, is there any tip or any recommendation?
I mean, it really is presenting oneself as sincere and oneself as open for sharing, being vulnerable. In fact, it was someone from your team just this past week who paraphrased it nicely. Vulnerability leads to complexity. This is something I've appreciated more and more as I've gotten older, as complexity is the nature of life, if that's the gig. So acknowledging complexity, being comfortable with ambiguity, not simply accepting one's professional title as the definition of the person I'm speaking with or even the reason I'm with them. Embracing complexity, telling the more complex and accurate story, as an American writer, Rebecca Solnit, called it. I absolutely love that. And the dialogue leads to embracing that complex story, touching upon it, and really telling the story, the details of the story, not merely that I went on a trip to Europe. That's not a story. The details of the story, the moments, the settings, as if you're recreating a storyboard of that moment, even though it may be somewhat inaccurate and it may have been years or decades ago.
Earlier this week, I remember you saying that design is Shakespeare and go for the 1,000 calorie answer and not the 1 calorie answer. Can you say something about that, this connection between design, complexity, and Shakespeare? And why is this important?
Well, the legacy of design is, I think, often misunderstood, that design is really only 125 years old as a profession, so it's fairly young. But still, there is this century-plus legacy. Much of that inheritance from the 20th century was that we should reduce and simplify, from which came the tagline and form follows function and such. And that was misunderstood to mean the simple answer, the 1 calorie answer, the make America great again answer, whereas we know the answer is much more complex, much more interesting. And in that longer 1,000 calorie answer is something closer to the truth and really the pleasure of the dialogue in that 1,000 calorie answer. So when I'm speaking to somebody new in a business context or in a random context, as I told you, I try to meet 10 new people every week. I want to facilitate the 1,000 calorie answer by at first opening the door with some of those 1 calorie answers as to what I do, but I will cue that into whomever I'm speaking with. And then slowly I will reveal more of the details of this wonderful life that I've created for myself.
I'm curious about how does all this complexity come out in your work?
My work really is the dialogue. I'm a professor, so I engage in months-long, years-long relationships with students, and I try to not see them as a cohort, but as individuals, and I will give as much extra time as is needed, especially those who indicate that they are ready for that sharing of the complex story. In my work with commercial clients, it's also not giving them a habitual response. I try to give responses without using the word design. I know that's what this podcast is about, but respond without using the primary words of design so that we don't have flattened 1 calorie responses. So the response is never an app, a website. That's never the answer. It always is a complex condition, which is more like a piece of Shakespeare.
Can you tell us what was your original moment of manifestation and how it has impacted and shaped your life?
My answer as of a few years ago was a text I read when I was 18 that some of the people listening to this may recognize if they'd studied media or perhaps they're older than 40 or 50 years old. Marshall McLuhan was the academic equivalent of Andy Warhol, and he predicted with fairly good accuracy the world we live in today a half a century ago. I read him when I was 18, changed my course from being, thought I would be a photographer to being one curious about behavior. But as I embarked upon a more serious research of moments of original manifestation, last year I had a sabbatical from both of my schools, and I took that time to travel the world and interview 54 people about their moments. Then, of course, in setting that question into my subconscious, other answers arose as to my own. That memory that emerged was as a 10 or 11-year-old boy growing up in suburban Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I went to an automobile show with my father. I saw a concept automobile that I fell in love with, that I felt sexually excited about, if a 10-year-old can feel sexually excited. Part of that tableau was that 10, 15 feet, 3-4 meters to the left of this car was the real Miss America of that year. And as a 10-year-old boy, I was simultaneously frightened to death and enormously fascinated by what must this be, this 22-year-old woman with the classic mid-20th century figure and the glittery gown and the little tiara. So that concept car and its seductive design mixed with the multi-sensory experience of seeing a shapely woman in her 20s as a 10-year-old shy boy. And my father made me stand next to her to have my picture taken with her. I'm so frightened of that. But that was a very, very exciting moment that caused me to be sitting here with you today. It's all the millions and millions and millions of actions that have happened since being 10 years old are an attempt, and mostly a successful attempt, to recreate that excitement of multi-sensory promise, hope, joy, and the blank slate of the future, and design being one tool that is active therein.
In thinking about how you shaped your life, what were the most interesting or poignant moments of your life that you think is worth sharing?
As a child, it was a fascination with space. It was something about the otherness of space, the blank slate of space, that was attractive to me. I considered studying physics. I was interested in physics, but I switched to photography at 17 or 18 because there was no social life in physics in those days. Photography was a way for me to get close to people, so that was an important marker. Around 18 or 19 years old, it was I had my camera and I had an excuse to tell people, excuse me, I have to be here, I'm with my camera. Photography also generated a portfolio. In those days, it was a physical portfolio that I would have. And then I would actually take this physical portfolio, which was nearly a meter long by 2/3 of a meter high, very big case. And I would take that, I remember, on my first dates with women because I wanted them to look at the portfolio and not to look at me. I was still too shy to look at them, but I brought my portfolio. So photography with the portfolio was intimately connected with my evolving social life. At the same time, I was reading Marshall McLuhan, who said, it's not what you say, but how you say it and the media that you say it through. So in a way, photography and the portfolio of my work became an extension of who I am. He said, technology are extensions of who we are because we create them. So I felt that physically. I felt that very much physically. So that was an important marker. Then moving to another country, I lived mostly in the Netherlands for a decade between the age of 25, 26, 35, 36. The enormous exotica and strangeness, I was fascinated with door handles being different and the street sizes being different. And what was expected in a conversation with someone I had just met was radically different. All of those things I found quite rarefied and exciting. In that same period, I started to build artworks, which I now call design fiction, which were ways for me to understand myself better, to make statements about the world as it existed in those days and to some extent as it would be. This research has enabled me to gain access to many different parts of institutions in Europe and the US, and perhaps even why I'm here today is that I'm comfortable with business language. I do business. I'm interested and comfortable with artists. I seek them out specifically. They're very good at the kind of 10-year frame. And then I read theoretical texts and know people who write those theoretical texts who seem to be good, like McLuhan was, at the 20, 30, 40, 50-year frame.
You say you are a futurist and a designer. What is the role of designing futures in your view?
In its simplest definition, an innovative solution to a practical problem. So there is some practical aspect of what design is about that makes people a bit more comfortable with me than if I said that I was a futurist.
Yeah.
So design sounds pragmatic. As McLuhan said, it's like, if you don't like those answers, I'll give you other ones. So I use it as an entryway into these dialogues, these relationships, some of which result in me being able to come to Brazil and work for a week and meet interesting people like yourself.
Thanks. Earlier this week, you also said you have to fall in love with your future self.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Do you think humanity can fall in love with its future self? How do you see this connection of one falling in love with oneself, with one's future self, and humanity falling in love with its future self?
It sounds too easy to be true, but I noticed it anecdotally in my own life, and then a decade or so ago, I came upon a piece of academic research that said that simply envisioning what will make you happy in the future makes you happy, even if it actually doesn't. It's the envisioning and the thinking of your future self, which is a blissful, happy state. Mm. There will be a world 5 years from now, 50 years from now. There will be existence. There will be activity. There will be pleasure. Mm. So it's the envisioning of that future self, which in and of itself makes one happy.
And why do you think there are so many dystopic visions of the future?
You know, it's that one calorie answer. Like, if you have a dystopic vision, then you don't have to extend the 1,000 calories to portray the future. All futures are local, meaning my future may be different than yours. And that's now truer. It's something I believe in now that I did not understand 30 or 40 years ago, is that there are multiple thousands, millions of futures existing at the same time. Mm. It doesn't need just to be the future of Stanley Kubrick's 2001 or some other science fiction portrayal. And it doesn't need to come from where those ideas came from before. Mm. We can have these multiple futures, and then it's an exciting, more complex and accurate story of the future that begins to emerge. Mm.
What makes you happy about your future? What is the vision of your future that you want to fall in love with?
I am 69, so I know I'm not going to live to be 300 years. But 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, around the time I was turning 60, I saw a lot of people retiring who were my age or a bit older, and most of them were not happy. And I started investigating what it is to be happy in your 60s. I did research, I read, and I had this one discussion in particular with someone who's much younger than me, Matthias Jakobsen, which is how we came in contact with each other, a wonderful Dane who has become an American citizen living in New York, working with SY Partners, a very interesting consulting company. But he said, imagine that you will live multiple lifetimes. Just take that out of your calculation. Of course, I know I'm not going to live multiple lifetimes necessarily, but I noticed that people who continue to invest as long as they exist are the ones that are the most fulfilled, the happiest, if you will. Mm-hmm. And it harkens back to that envisioning one's future, that you will have a future, makes you happy in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And that certainly I'm not going to live 200 years, but the echoes that I leave here this week in São Paulo with the 50 people who were in a workshop I gave and the 20 or 30 other people that I've met thus far and just in day 4 or 5 now, that actually is a fairly good anecdote to everyone's fear of mortality, not knowing what awaits there, that there will be this echo that continues long after I don't exist.
When coming here to this studio, you talked about this 10% of effort that which takes 90% of the time and the endeavor to actually make things happen.
Right.
How do you see that in your life and the importance that it has had for your success and everything you have achieved?
When I was half the age I am now, I had a lot of good ideas and I was flailing around a lot. But I recall that 8 out of 10 of these initiatives just did not happen. Mm-hmm. It took me till I was in my 40s to realize that the scale of the endeavor to come as close as possible to perfection, if you will, or completeness, was much larger than I had envisioned as a child or even as a young adult. So it's that last 10%, the doggedness, the word I used in our ride over here, like a dog just holding on to the project as long as you possibly can until you fall over. What do you want to do and what are you willing to get there? is what is necessary to make a difference mostly. It's usually a question of time and effort and what you are willing to do to get there. Mm-hmm. The best of the best of what humanity has done, has to offer, the creation, is often mostly a result of this doggedness, this last 10%. And what starts out as an interesting idea, but which does not have much of a life or much of an effect, is often that last 10% was abandoned. Mm. There's a physical tiredness, there's an intellectual tiredness. People get sick, people are upset, etc. Friendships are tentative, and then those things tend to derail many of us from finishing that last 10%.
Mm. Well, thank you. I think that's a great moment to perhaps end this conversation. Thank you very much, Tom. It was
a
pleasure.
And
I hope the people
appreciated it.
Thanks. And I hope that the people who are listening to us enjoy this conversation as much as I have. Thank you.
Thank you. And see you in the future.
It's incredible to see how he talks about connection between design and futurism, the existence of multiple futures and the happiness that can be derived by envisioning and thinking of one's future as a way of confronting and acknowledging one's fear of mortality. That's crazy, right? Tom also touched upon a very important aspect for getting our ideas and best visions come true: tenacity and determination. This is what we call the last mile of design. What they say in the Netherlands, and he explained to us, design the hell out of it, meaning design it as if your life depended on it. I love that. The best designs come when we have this mindset. So to end this episode, we would like to encourage you to look back into your childhood and examine the moments that transformed you and your life. Understanding these moments and how they created your future is key to the next step. Now, project a bit farther into the future. Who do you see? What is going on there? And then finally, ask yourself, are you falling in love with that future self? We'd like to leave you with this question today. In our next episode, we're going to be featuring a great friend and partner, Sheena Bala, from Google News Initiative Asia. Sheena worked with us to design desirable futures for media organizations in the Asia-Pacific region. We explore this topic and ask the question, can we design a future for media that is truly desirable by their audiences and that will keep media and news businesses thriving in the future? We hope to see you soon.